Salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, October 16th of the year 2015. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who is so glad that you can be back with us here for this very special edition of The Arcade.
Indeed, and as always, I am the second voice on this program, and this week I am Dennis, the man who wonders who died and put the librarians of the Chicago Public Library in charge of replacing the traditional anniversary gifts.
It's a very long-winded nickname there.
Yes, it's also not really related to what we're talking about here, but it sort of is in a roundabout way, so I'll explain. We are going to be talking about a very specific 30th anniversary of something very near and dear to us on this program, but, you know, in doing so, we usually spitball ideas before the show, trying to figure out what we can use for my nickname for the show to try to work some sort of joke in related to something that we want to talk about. And this week we thought, maybe we'll look up what the 30th anniversary gift is for, you know, wedding anniversary or whatever. And as it turns out, it is Pearl, according to traditional US and UK traditions on Wikipedia on the wedding anniversary page. But for some strange reason, like there's two columns. I mean, I understand the traditional US column and the traditional UK column. Those make sense. Mm-hmm. Fine. But for some weird reason, there's a third column that's called the suggested modern gift list created by the librarians at the Chicago Public Library. My mind went to what? Why? What gives them the right or authority to replace the gifts, the traditional gifts? Like, this being a librarian who deals in the Dewey Decimal System and books and cataloging books, does that give you the sudden authority on gifts for specific years?
Also, too, why the Chicago Public Library?
Yes, why that library?
That specific one. It's not the, I guess, North American Public Librarians Association or anything of that nature. No, it's just that one specific library. Are they the ones who edit and keep up this one Wikipedia page on traditional anniversary gifts? This is just what they do in between shushing people?
Yes, and if that's what they do, what's wrong with Pearl for the 30th anniversary? And why did you replace it with Diamond? And also, why does Diamond appear two more times in the list? Seems to me like they're not only just kind of weird and lazy with their naming of things, but they just sort of can't remember what they've done previously.
Well, if you're making it to those higher anniversary milestones, you are certainly getting up there in age, and you might have forgotten about your diamonds, so you'll just be reminded, hey, it's a diamond anniversary, and think it's a whole new diamond when it could just be a regifting of what you got for the 30th anniversary. I don't know. I'm not a librarian at the Chicago Public Library.
Therefore, you're not technically, you know, qualified enough to rename the traditional wedding anniversary gifts.
Story of my life. I'm not qualified to rename traditional wedding anniversary gifts.
If only you were a librarian at the Chicago Public Library, then all would be well. But yes, anyways, what this roundabout, long-winded rant at the Chicago Public Library librarians is really for is that, yes, it is indeed the 30th anniversary something, and that something is the Nintendo Entertainment System.
That is correct. We are using this week's episode to celebrate the milestone of the fact that 30 years ago this weekend, the Nintendo Entertainment System was released in North America. Now, it wasn't an all-at-once release, we should say, and it wasn't, I guess...
It didn't go as swimmingly right off the hop. It wasn't just a hit-the-ground-running success.
And certainly not, and even the launch lineup of games, maybe, as we look back, wasn't loaded with stellar games. There was things, or titles such as 10-Yard Fight, Clu-Clu-Land,
It's not that other thing you were going to say by accident.
Excuse me. Clu-Clu-Land, Stack Up, Gyromite, Balloon Fight, that maybe weren't as stellar and aren't as fondly remembered through history, but there were other games such as Excitebike, which certainly are still very stellar games even to this day.
Yes.
And so it wasn't the greatest, but then again, no system really has an amazing top to bottom launch lineup.
No.
There's always going to be some duds.
Yes. And even
mixed in.
As years go on, I think that becomes less and less. We're expecting less and less of launch lineups now. I mean, it's just a sort of a thing that's happening.
And this is true. But around 17 games launched alongside the NES on October 18th, 1985. And so we were wondering and spitballing and just trying to generate ideas for what we could do for this week's episode. We knew the anniversary was this week, and the NES is important not just to our own personal lives and our gaming history, and also it's important to the lives of so many other people out there, and as being a touchstone of your youth and growing up in development, and also it being an entry point into video gaming. But it's also very important to the story of modern video gaming.
Indeed, because most of us who are sort of our age group anyways, we don't really remember the first age of video games because we were kind of too young for it, or not born yet, when their video games had a first heyday, and then there was a huge market crash, and video games almost stopped being a thing entirely at that market crash point.
They almost really did become just nothing. They almost became
just a blip in history, like a fad. Mm-hmm. That would have, like the hula hoop or something that would have just kind of crashed and burned.
Or the pet rock.
Yeah, the pet rock. Exactly.
Which, if you don't remember the pet rock and have never heard of the pet rock, good God, look up the pet rock and you'll wonder, how did this ever happen? Drugs.
The 1960s was a thing. It really was a thing, people. But yeah, video games were very much at risk of being just like that.
They certainly were. And if it wasn't for Nintendo and the launch of the Nintendo Entertainment System, demonstrating that there was still a demand for electronic games to be played at home or inside people's homes on the living room television, we might not have the gaming industry we have today, worth tens of billions of dollars, some years worth more than the revenues of Hollywood movies.
Yes, I believe actually Phantom Pain, Metal Gear Solid 5, according to a recent post on Destructoid, they said that the day one earnings of Metal Gear Solid 5 outpaced the day one earnings of Jurassic World and Avengers combined at $179 million. Just $179 million of revenue brought in on day one from a video game.
That's a lot of dollars.
Yes, it is.
And would we be able to sit here today and tell you that, to share that information and talk about the fact that a video game, a piece of electronic entertainment that you put into your console, which is plugged into your television in whichever room, earned more dollars, more revenue in its first day of launch than two of the biggest movie releases this year, if it were not for the launch of the NES back in 1985.
Indeed.
Would the video game universe as we know it today exist? Or would we be in some bizarro universe, some alternate history type universe where the Nintendo was never released? It was only ever the Sega Mega Drive and the Sega Genesis. This is where the world where Sega just reigned supreme for years. It was some piece of alternate history fiction where Russia won the Cold War or whatnot. Or
the Nazis won World War II.
Exactly. Yeah. But none of those things happened. Those are not events that took place.
That is not an accurate portrayal of world history.
And instead we sit here today with 30 years of Nintendo being a gaming company in our lives, bringing out new consoles, new games, new systems, and being an absolute staple of the industry. And their character games, specifically Mario ones, being the go-to ones that so many people just know. And Mario as a character being a character that just so many people know and are able to recognize on a worldwide basis.
Indeed.
And so we thought it would be very important to honor this anniversary of the NES releasing in North America. And we decided that it would be best not to simply sit here and sermonize and go on and on and simply recite the history of Nintendo for you.
Yeah, we decided that we would kind of defer to some people that might know a little bit more of what they're talking about than we do. People who have written books on the topic of video games, specifically the history of various things, such as video games at large, the technical histories, or specifically the history of the Nintendo company.
Indeed, and we have three interviews with three authors coming up on the program today. Yes, three. That's more than we've done in the previous number of years.
Yes.
We really shot for the moon, and we're happy with how it all turned out. But our first portion of our interview today, because we, of course, had interviews that went much longer, but for time, we have to condense things down to portions and excerpts. But we spoke with the author of the book Super Mario: How Nintendo Conquered America, written by Jeff Ryan. And we spoke to him and got a little bit of background on Nintendo, its history up to that point, the release of the Nintendo Entertainment System in 1985. And, you know, I think instead of just talking about it, maybe we should go to it. Mr. Ryan, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here on the Arcade.
No problem, guys. Glad to help.
Well, we have you here because your book is a history book of Nintendo, and certainly we're here on this episode focusing on Nintendo and the release of the Nintendo Entertainment System to North American audiences. And Nintendo considers internally that October 18th, 1985 as being the official release date of the NES, but that was not a nationwide release. When you were going through and researching Super Mario, what did you find out about the release and the gradual rollout approach that Nintendo took with the NES, which is kind of different from what we see with major technology releases now, where often they're just all in one territory, all across the country, all in one shot?
Right. A lot of times it's called day and date, where if a movie comes out, it comes out in thousands of theaters and you see it the same time as everyone else. And Nintendo would have loved to have done that with Nintendo, but 85 was coming just a year or two after the great video game crash of 1983. That was only in North America. But because of that, toy stores didn't want to put any sort of video game systems on their shelves because they hadn't been selling well the last couple of years. So Nintendo decided, we are not going to sell a video game system. We are going to sell a robot toy, and we are going to package the actual video game system as a stealth accessory to our robot toy. And this sounded great on paper, and the robot called Rob, the robotic operating buddy, if I remember the acronym right, looked kind of cool. He didn't really do much of anything, but that didn't matter. It was a Trojan horse. But it turns out that the American toy manufacturers had also read The Odyssey, so they knew what a Trojan horse was, and they looked at this robot attached to a video game system, and they just said no. So that's why it didn't launch everywhere.
So Rob was only, if I recall correctly, Rob was only compatible with Gyromite as well, which kind of makes that hilarious.
Yeah, Gyromite, and I think there was one other game you could do something with, like a Burger Time-esque game. So they decided that since New York City is the base of the world toy market, that if they individually hand sold all of their Nintendo products in New York toy stores, then the New York toy intelligentsia would see them on the shelves and see them in action, see the displays, and then think, oh, maybe this is something I can start selling for next year or next quarter. And that basically did not work. They were able to make their money back just barely, and they more or less rented the store spaces. So if you put 100 game systems in your KB or your EB Games or whatever it is, Nintendo bought back any unsold copies. So there was no downside to anyone in the electronics world or in the toy world. This was free money, because there's no stocking fees and you didn't need to worry about money, because if you didn't sell all 100, Nintendo would come and take the rest back and you'd get your money's work.
So about how long did it take for Nintendo to eventually roll out the NES across America and then eventually into Canada? But from that starting point of in New York of October 18, 1985, how long before the nation eventually got it?
It was another whole year after Nintendo, which was based in the Seattle area, when they really broke their back trying to sell the NES and it didn't work out that well, they licked their wounds and they went back to the Seattle area and they decided, let's do it again. Let's go market by market all year long. So they went to Los Angeles and Chicago, I think Phoenix or Denver or somewhere. I forget all the specific places, but toy stores are more amenable when it's not the Christmas season. And they did that enough times so that when 1986 came around, it finally worked and toy manufacturers said, okay, fine, you can start selling Nintendo Entertainment Systems on our shelves. And that's when people actually started to buy them because they could finally buy them.
Now, when we think back to the NES, a lot of us will remember it at that time as being just a huge success. Was it accepted as a wild success once it hit a nationwide release in 1986, or was it even after that point a slow build?
It was not a slow build. It was pretty big. Atari had been massive. So for the better part of one or two console generations, Atari was huge. So the audience was ready for a new video game system with better graphics than Atari was offering, and Nintendo was the one to deliver that. So Nintendo had something like 90% market share within a year or two. So it wasn't a slow flame. It was a slow flame in 1985 and 1986, and then in 1987, it just exploded.
Now, one of the facts I remember hearing, even just on the playground at recess, in whatever gaming magazine, Urban Legends, I should probably characterize it better as, and not a fact, but was that Nintendo was so successful with the NES that they were able to build up the proverbial war chest, just savings of billions and billions and billions of dollars that they accumulated because the NES was such a massive success, had such a penetration rate into American homes. Was that actually true? Did Nintendo actually accrue and are they still sitting on just the war chest of the NES billions?
It's true and not true. It's true that it was a huge success and they made a huge amount of money and they're sitting on that money to this day. What's not true about it is that that makes it sound like this is where Nintendo made its money. It made its money way back 5 years earlier when Donkey Kong came out. That earned them $180 million its first year in 1981 and then another $100 million in its second year.
That's impressive numbers, certainly. Nothing to sneeze at. And Donkey Kong really was Nintendo's first success, which almost didn't work out. There's an interesting story to how Donkey Kong came about into North American arcades, that it was really the last hope for Nintendo and their arcade business, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was their first slash last hope. They were going to sell 3,000 copies of a Space Invaders clone called Radar Scope. And I challenge anyone who is a video game collector to find a copy of Radar Scope because hardly any of them exist anymore. They did sell about 1,000, but all the rest were unsold. And long story short, what Nintendo did, their stroke of genius, their game changer was to literally change the game, rip out the motherboard, and put in a new game. That new game was Donkey Kong, designed by Shigeru Miyamoto. It's his first game, and he's now considered the world's greatest video game designer.
Well, it's definitely a good title to have under your belt.
Certainly a strong starting point. And now as Nintendo moved along and ultimately transitioned from the arcades to the home console business, obviously every system we know now and accept needs kind of that killer app. What would you say was the proverbial killer app for the Nintendo Entertainment System?
This is a really interesting question. A guy on Gamma Sutra was trying to figure out when Super Mario Brothers became that killer app. The short answer is it's Super Mario Brothers, one of the top-selling games of all time, the top-selling game of all time until Wii Sports came out and everyone bought a Wii, so therefore everyone bought a Wii Sports. But he was simply trying to find out when in October of 1985, they started to sell the NES, if you could buy a copy of Super Mario Brothers. And he realized no one knows. There is nothing in the documents that clearly says, no, it's not for sale yet, or yes, it is for sale. No one from the time remembers it. No one who was running stores or buying games at the time has any recall if Super Mario was for sale or not. It's, you know, it's not in the distant past, but it's like a bit of information that we just don't have, which is staggering.
I guess the poor record keeping of the 80s.
An interesting tidbit that it's, you know, that its release date has kind of been lost to time. In your research, what other facts, what other tidbits did you find that stood out to you as being particularly surprising about Nintendo and the NES back in 1985 and really that whole first generation? Was there one that stood out to you more than everything else as being, wow, this is head-scratching, eyebrow-raising, or whatnot?
The brief foray of Nintendo's travels in the entertainment world where they were trying to get into movies. They made a movie called The Wizard, which basically they just said, you can make an hour and a half long commercial with Christian Slater and Fred Savage going across the country playing Nintendo games. And Universal made that. Nintendo decided it was going to get into the market and make its own game, or its own video game movie, which was the first true video game movie, like an adaptation of a video game. That was the Super Mario Brothers movie, which is bad in so many ways. You could devote a whole episode just to it. But the original star of Super Mario Brothers, the guy they wanted to be Mario, was Tom Hanks.
That would have been a really different movie.
Nintendo had Tom Hanks let go of the project because he cost too much money and they felt he was not a bankable movie star. Now, at the time, that was actually true. This was not the back-to-back Oscars Tom Hanks. This is not the Apollo 13 guy. This was the Joe versus the Volcano Tom Hanks.
The Splash Hanks.
But hey, Money Pit is still a good movie. I don't care what anyone says.
Come on.
And I'll put Double Dragon up there also. That's an entertaining watch.
Oh, it certainly is. Now, at one point, Mario had just achieved such pop culture success and such penetration and such recognition. Is it true that Mario, or perhaps Nintendo, was one of, if not the most well-known brands? Was Mario more popular than other pop stars and icons of the time?
Yes, but there's an asterisk next to that claim. What you're talking about is something called Q ratings. I don't know what Q stands for. I don't think Q actually stands for anything. It's just a cool sounding letter. And you can hire a company to check for your Q ratings of your product or intellectual property or brand next to others. But you are the one paying the company that comes up with Q ratings. So they have a vested interest in making your score higher or asking questions where your brand looks good. So if Coca-Cola's Q rating said it looked much better than competing sodas, it might be competing with RC Cola instead of competing with Pepsi.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. So according to that Q rating with that asterisk now attached to it, Super Mario is as well known as Mickey Mouse.
Interesting. That's, well, certainly why there's a whole generation of us who have such fondness and affinity for the character from back in the time. Now, your book tells the story of Nintendo almost through the story of Mario games as they go along. Is there one of those Mario games that you personally enjoy more than the rest?
Oh, my favorite is easily Super Mario Brothers 3, which is an NES title. And the reason why it's my favorite is because they took all of the exploration and all of the world building of the first Super Mario Brothers, and they added a little bit of the fun of the second Super Mario, but they added a map level. Have you played the game recently? Do you remember the map level?
I have not fired it up in many years. I am sad to say.
If you've played any Mario side-scroller in the last 10 years, you know what the map level is, where you'll see World 1-1, but it's on, like, It's on an overhead map where you can walk to a bunch of different levels.
Yep.
Ah, yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Super Mario 3 was the first to include that. And it was like a meta game where the game itself is to get through all the levels. Just, you know, keep moving to the right, overcoming your obstacles. But the meta game is to check off all of the boxes, to visit all the different levels, because there's always a way for you to get from where you're trying to go to where you're going without hitting every spot on the map. But you don't do that. You go to all of the other nooks and cranny spots and finish all the side quests. And you don't have to do that. The game doesn't reward you more for it, but it's just like, you know, you paid money for this, so you might as well get your full ticket.
Yeah, I was going to say there's like sort of like a risk reward with that as well, too, where they make it really kind of dangerous for you to do that in some cases, where you can skip ahead, but if you lose all your lives, it's back to the start, then you kind of have to go through all the levels again otherwise. So, yeah.
Right. And they've made it much easier in recent years where if you die, it just says, you have another 5 lives. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
And Mario or Luigi has another 5 lives. Like, oh, okay. Well, lesson learned. I can do anything because my parents will bail me out.
Now, how long did it take you to actually go through and do the research and compile all your ducks in a row when writing Super Mario?
I had been working on another video game project. It would have been a coffee table book on the history of video games, but it turns out that's not how you write coffee table books. The coffee table book people go to you, you don't go to them. So after about a year, I found out, oh, you're not allowed to do this. So I had all of this information about video games, and I couldn't put it all into a book, and it wasn't going to be a book with pictures, so I thought that Mario was the way I could use the most of the research and throw away the least amount of it. Because if you tell the story of Mario games, you tell the story of Nintendo. And if you tell the story of Nintendo, you tell the story of gaming. And if you tell the story of gaming, you have, in a very small way, told the story of the last 30 years of America.
Would that be one of the reasons maybe why Mario as a character is still going so strong and still endearing to so many people and so many new generations that come along and encounter the franchise?
I think so. It's probably not the fact that people love overweight plumbers. That doesn't seem to be the big drawing point of Mario. The big drawing point of Mario is that he's an avatar for you. He has a very specific look, but that works just fine with you because you don't have that specific look. And I'm not in the studio, so I don't know if you are, in fact, overweight mustache plumbers. If you are, then maybe you have a super affinity for Mario. But otherwise, he's a different guy. He's not you. And that's okay.
Now, as you explored the history of Nintendo through Mario games as well, and which ultimately is kind of the history of gaming over the past 30 years, what surprised you the most as Nintendo went forward through the years, moving past the 8-bit generation into the 16-bit generation, as a company, as they were moving forward through time?
What surprised me was their philosophy of only picking some of the fruit on the bush. I'm used to thinking of however commerce works, whatever your industry is, as maximizing profits. You know, if it's possible to sell 8,000 units instead of 7,000, you do the extra work to sell the 8,000 units. And Nintendo is the opposite. Nintendo was like, maybe we'll only sell 3,000 units this year. That way, next year, we'll be sure that more people will want it than ever before. And then they won't jack up the prices. They won't do anything to capitalize on the fact that there are much more people that want to buy their products than they're letting buy their products. They leave so much money on the table every year. And you can see that in the fact that they haven't made any TV or movies with their characters, which is like the richest intellectual property in the world. They do hardly anything with them other than make games. And they're only making games for themselves, not for other consoles.
Mr. Ryan, we thank you so much for joining us here on this edition of the Arcade. Tell our listeners how they can go about and pick up a copy of your book Super Mario for themselves and add it to their game book collection.
It's an Amazon Books a Million. If you have a library near you, it's probably there. There's an audiobook version. You can listen on Audible. I recently started to use a service called Hoopla, which is available via your library, and you can listen to it for free on Hoopla if your library participates in the Hoopla Hoopla.
Awesome. We thank you so much for joining us on the Arcade here. We'd love to have you on again at some point in the future to talk.
Thanks, guys.
It certainly feels good to be able to defer to someone who has definitely done a lot more research than we would have.
Infinitely more. Really, when you're writing a book, that book becomes your life, especially if you want it published
yes.
by a major company to then reap all the monies that come with it, I assume. I don't know. I've never written a book.
Yes.
But our thanks once again to Jeff Ryan for joining us. We'll have the link to his book, Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America, right on our website, thearcadeshow.com, as well as links for all the other books from the different authors we have on this show, because it's not just Jeff Ryan we're speaking to. He gave us a nice little bit of history about Nintendo at the time, but we wanted to know a bit more about some of the stories, some of the people at Nintendo of America at that time for the launch of the NES in 1985.
Yes, and who better to talk to about that other than Blake Harris? Blake J. Harris.
Blake J. Harris, author of the book Console Wars, which it does tell the story of Sega and Nintendo battling out during the 16-bit era, but he does also have a chapter in there talking about the release in 1985 of the NES, and it is from his book, Console Wars, that I learned, and you'll get to learn, of a man whose name isn't really as well known in video game history. It is not really spoken of in such illustrious terms or as glowingly as, say, Shigeru Miyamoto, Satoru Iwata, Gunpei Yokoi, Hiroshi Yamauchi. Doesn't seem to be on that level. That man is Minoru Arakawa. And Blake J. Harris told us about Minoru Arakawa, as well as the Canadian connection that Nintendo of America had at the time. There was some Maple Leaf content
Indeed.
To Nintendo of America in 1985 at the time of the NES releasing, which I was surprised by. I know you were surprised
by.
Yeah,
I was quite surprised myself.
And so let's go to that that portion of the Blake J. Harris interview right now. Mr. Harris, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on the Arcade.
Thank you for bringing me to the Canadian airwaves. It's good to be chatting with you guys.
We always aim to bring a new audience to our writers, to the guests we have on, and we like bringing Canadian people to the world. We're not as closed off as some people may think we are.
I never took you guys for xenophobes. Don't worry.
We're having you on this episode to talk a bit about your book, Console Wars, which is kind of a video game history book, but you take a bit of a different perspective, say, differing from David Sheff's Game Over. You talk specifically kind of about the 16-bit era with Sega and Nintendo going head-to-head. Why did you choose to make that your focus?
Well, a couple of reasons. I would say first and foremost, because I grew up during that era of gaming, so it has a special place in my heart. I'm 32 years old. So, you know, the 8-bit days and the 16-bit days were the biggest days of gaming for me. And I think that back then, I don't know that the word gamer existed. You were just a kid. And if you wanted to have other friends that were kids, you had to play video games. So that was a big part of it. And then in terms of the style of the book and, you know, the reference you made to Game Over, it's a little bit different focus. But my favorite books to read as an adult are behind the scenes stories. And David Sheff's was really the only book that I could find in the video game world that took me behind the scenes in the way that I wanted to be, where I get to know these people. I get to know the business. I get to learn about the development of the games. And sort of tells a larger story. And so I was reading his book and I absolutely loved it. But I felt like as it was getting to the most exciting part of the story, that was when it ended. You know, it ends in 1992, I believe. It came out in 93. And as much as I love the book, it does sort of end with there's this thing on the horizon called the internet and the World Wide Web and multimedia, and who knows what tomorrow will bring. And, you know, I felt like 1992 was the year that Sega surpassed Nintendo for a period of time, and then things got really exciting with Mortal Kombat and the violence and the ratings board. So I always kind of viewed my book as a spiritual successor to David Sheff's book. And also in terms of the focus on Sega, I felt like, you know, part of what inspired me to write the book, not as many books about video games as one would expect for an industry that's so big and so exciting. And I really wanted to write a story that could draw in readers that were maybe more like myself, who hadn't played video games in years, more like my parents who didn't know the first thing about video games, or people who absolutely loved video games. And so I felt like the way to do that was to focus, at least for the first part of the book, on this underdog battle between Sega and Nintendo. And I think that worked. I was happy with how it turned out.
Now, as much as your book focuses on the console wars, Sega versus Super Nintendo, or sorry, Genesis versus Super Nintendo, you do still pay some respects to the 8-bit system with the NES, with one chapter on the release of the NES back in 1985. And one of the names that I read in your book that I really didn't know before and strikes me as a name that really should maybe stand out better in history alongside Yamauchi, Iwata, and Miyamoto of the time was Minoru Arakawa, who was the head of Nintendo of America of the time. Who, maybe just to give a brief background for our listeners, who was Minoru Arakawa at the time, and why was he kind of an important figure in the launch of the NES back in 1985?
You're totally spot on. I would say he's the most important figure with the launch of the NES and bringing Nintendo to America. You know, for one, that was his job. He was the president of Nintendo of America. He was actually the son-in-law of Hiroshi Yamauchi. So, you know, sometimes it would maybe seem like he didn't get the full respect he was due because he was a son-in-law, and people thought, oh, he's the son-in-law, even though that was more just, he happened to, you know, that was his entry into the company, but what he did was amazing. So he originally was, in the real estate business up in Canada, I believe in Vancouver, and, his father-in-law, Hiroshi Yamauchi, wanted him to take Nintendo, which was getting into the arcade business with, you know, which eventually kind of hit a high point with Donkey Kong in 1980. He wanted him to bring Nintendo to America, and Mr. Arakawa was very skeptical. You know, he didn't like the idea of working for his father-in-law because he felt like maybe his accomplishments wouldn't be viewed as his own. He didn't necessarily have any interest in video games. But eventually, after seeing the content and speaking with his wife and seeing this opportunity, he was persuaded. And so he opened up, you know, the original Nintendo of America headquarters, which was very small, had probably about 10 employees. They only did arcade games and then Game & Watch games. And then after the Famicom, a family computer came out in Japan, which was their 8-bit system. Basically, it was the NES, the original version that came out in Japan. You know, after that was successful in 1983, it was decided to try to bring this to America. And, you know, one thing I was completely oblivious to as a kid was that there was this video game crash and that nobody in America wanted this, which I know in hindsight probably sounds ridiculous given that video games are now a $60+ billion industry, bigger than music and film. But, you know, I don't think at the time it was that ridiculous because the so-called computer revolution was in the midst. It was happening. It was coming. And I could have very easily imagined a world where games were just played on computers instead of with dedicated consoles that cost $200. So it really took a lot of vision and dedication by Minoru Arakawa to go forward with that. And so in 1985, Nintendo decided, despite focus group testing that said the NES would be a huge failure, they decided to bring it to America. They did a test launch in New York. I spoke with several of the sales reps at Nintendo whose job it was to almost literally go door to door to these electronic stores and say, hey, will you sell this product? And nobody wanted to, because those people that they were trying to sell to had gotten their jobs because the person before them had invested in video games and bought video games and the market had crashed. So it was very tough. Nintendo did some clever strategic things to try to get around that. Some of that was just the vernacular and how they marketed the product. You know, instead of this being a video game console like the Atari 2600 or the Magnavox Odyssey or the Intellivision, this was a Nintendo Entertainment System. It was an entertainment system. It was a, had a control deck. It had a control pad. It didn't have a joystick. It had a zapper, which was the gun. You know, they got, and also the games weren't cartridges. They were game packs. So they got kind of clever with the way that they were phrased all these things, at least to the extent of getting it into the retailers. And then they also came up with Rob the Robot, which was a terrible product. Didn't really work well with any game, but it showed that this game was, you know, the NES was an entertainment system that had a cool Japanese robot. So it wasn't like the Atari 2600. No need to worry. And so kind of through all of this and through Arakawa, I started to see that yes, technically the book that I was writing was about Sega Nintendo from 1990 to 1996 or during the 16-bit era. But, you know, it's so easy to pit this as a story of, you know, a good guy versus bad guy or a David versus a Goliath, which in many ways it was. But 5 years earlier, Nintendo was David and their own David and Goliath story. And so I felt like it was really important to get that across as well and to show that Minoru Arakawa was the guy leading the ship. And, you know, one thing I learned from interviewing so many people, and not just for this book, but for other things, that's, you know, you always have to take what people say with a grain of salt. You know, the way we talk about ourselves is not always the way that others perceive us and what actually happened. And so I put a lot of stock in how other people describe someone. And everybody I spoke with at Nintendo said they, you know, Minoru Arakawa was just basically the greatest guy ever. You know, you couldn't have asked for better things. So I do think that he was the most important, compelling figure at the time and a name that most people should know.
Now, as we are a podcast that emanates out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, one of the interesting things I found is there was some Canadian content to Nintendo of America back in 1985 leading up to and during the release of the NES. As you mentioned earlier, Arakawa was actually a selling real estate in Vancouver for a period of time. But another name that came up as being Canadian and having some Canadian content to Nintendo was, I believe, Pete Main at the time. Who was he and how did he get to his position as being, I believe, as you said in the book, one of, if not the third highest person at Nintendo of America?
Yeah, so, you know, the two highest people at Nintendo from basically the early to mid-80s through the end of the, like, to around the year 2000 were Minoru Arakawa and Howard Lincoln. They sort of went a little bit back and forth between who is the number one top dog, but ultimately it was a great partnership and they were both kind of co-leaders. And then Peter Main, was the executive vice president of sales and marketing. And he was definitely sort of the next, you know, part of the trio of leadership and sort of the next man, on the totem pole. And he is a very interesting character who is Canadian. Aside from him having I really enjoy his personality and his quirks and what he did at Nintendo. I'm always fascinated by the people who were complete outsiders to the video game industry and how the way they saw things ultimately changed things a bit. And so Peter was a Canadian from Vancouver who happened to be Minoru Arakawa's neighbor. And I guess early on in their relationship, when the Arakawas moved in, there was an issue with cutting down a tree. And Peter Main was able to persuade Mr. Arakawa to do what he wanted him to do. And so in Mr. Arakawa's mind, he always remembered that this was a guy who was very persuasive and could get things done. And sort of on a more serious note or where he acquired those skills was he had done a lot of marketing for a lot of, big successful organizations. More recently during that time, he was in the fast food business. He had managed or been high up in the White Spot franchise and other fast food businesses. And so in about 1986, after Nintendo had introduced this NES and it was successful, Minoru Arakawa wanted someone who could explain that the success was here to stay, you know, because the criticism for video games was that they were just a fad, that it was, you know, like the Cabbage Patch doll, all over again, or the hula hoop. And so they wanted someone who could speak to investors and speak to journalists and show them that this is not Cabbage Patch Dolls. This is the beginning of a new industry. And Peter was really great at doing that. He was, he had the experience speaking with the financial community as a member of leadership groups in Canada and being on those boards. And then he also kind of had success on the ground and, you know, knew how to create a nimble organization and really do sort of more grassroots type stuff, and which is what Nintendo needed at the time. So he was kind of the guy who helped take them to that next tier from success to sustained success.
All right. One last question before we let you go here. Mr. Harris, do you still have your old systems? Do you still have them hooked up, and do you get any chance at every so often to fire them up and just rekindle those old memories you might have of the NES, the Genesis, perhaps even the Sega CD if you were so lucky to have one?
Well, I was not lucky enough to have a Sega CD or 32X or any of those fun things. You know, it was already a struggle enough to get our parents to get us the Genesis when we already had the NES. But, you know, as I speak to you, I am staring at my, my 8-bit Nintendo Entertainment System, the very same one I had when I was a kid. And it's on top of a stack of, old games. So, you know, personally, I just love the aesthetics of that, you know. There's obviously a lot of love for that time from a nostalgic point of view. And, you know, I tried as often as possible not to let that bleed into the story because I wanted it to be relatable to anyone of any generation. But on a personal, inspirational level, it was always nice to walk by here and see the cartridges for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Mario Brothers 2, Bases Loaded, and all these great games that provided so many hours of fun as a kid. And so I definitely played that, and I played my Genesis, when I was writing the book. You know, that was, business expense, and it was technically quote unquote research. And you know, I think it's really meaningful, and it's really cool that a lot of people still play those games. You know, I think that there's a temptation to say that the reason that we do is because of nostalgia, and I have no doubt that that's part of it. But I do think that those games are part of a golden era of gaming, and that is why they're so fun. And you know, part of my evidence, at least to me, of that is I've spoken at a few schools of high school kids that were obviously not even alive during this time period, and they seem to still really the early Mario games, the early Zelda games, and things like that. So there was certainly something to that, because I'm not going around playing, you know, Pitfall and Pac-Man as much as they are playing these games that were from the 8-bit and 16-bit era.
Mr. Harris, thank you so much for taking the time out of your night to join us here. Just tell our listeners, where can they go pick up your book, Console Wars, to read it and enjoy it for themselves?
They can pick up the book anywhere, I would hope, online, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, anything like that, and hopefully in any bookstore.
Perfect. We'll put a link to it in our show notes. Thank you so much for taking the time out to join us for this episode of The Arcade. We really enjoyed it, and we'd love to have you on again at any point in the future.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Hopefully, maybe when the documentary comes out, I can come back on.
Awesome. We'll look forward to talking to you then.
All right. Have a great night, guys.
Bye now.
And that's all you really need to ever hear of Wall Street Kid. That's all the music in the game, and it's now in your head forever. And if it's not, play the game for 5 minutes, and then it will be in your head forever. But yes, many thanks.
You're welcome for that, by the way.
Yes, and once again, many thanks to Blake J. Harris for coming on the show.
Yeah, taking the time to I was going to say sit down with us. In a sense, he was.
I'm assuming he was sitting down over Skype.
Yes, certainly.
Maybe he was standing up. We can't tell.
He fit us into his schedule. We didn't have a whole lot of time to talk to him. He had another interview lined up after us, so we didn't want to take up all of his evening. But we are thankful, again, that he was able to talk to us about Console Wars and the story of Nintendo releasing it at the time. And I was just blown away that there was some Canadian content, that Peter Main was one of the higher ups of Nintendo at the time, and he was from Vancouver, straight Vancouver, Canadian.
And he was hired because you know, they remembered him, oh, when he was our neighbor, he was persuasive. It's like, oh, that's a good way to get a job.
It works. Okay. And now, one thing we found when going through and actually trying to line up these interviews and then actually getting these interviews with these authors is that you feel pretty good. It's one thing to get a published author. It's another thing to get a published author who's sold their work and had the film rights picked up, and it's now in the process of becoming a documentary, then a full-length motion picture release, as is the case with Console Wars. But it's another thing entirely to land an interview with someone who's an honest-to-God PhD.
Yes, not just a PhD, but whose work has been published by the MIT Press.
Yes.
You know, MIT?
MIT?
That particular MIT that you may have heard about?
Yes, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, not the Michigan Institute of Tires.
Or the Manitoba Institute of Teaching People How to Read. Who do a very poor job of acronyms.
Yeah, obviously. So we managed to get an interview with a man named Nathan Altice. His name, you would look at it and think it's spelled or pronounced Altice. No, it's Altice.
Yes. Don't make that mistake.
We did. And
he corrected us very graciously. And we didn't say it on the air because, well, until now, I guess. we screwed it up.
Oh.
Go back.
Damn it. Where's the rewind button? Nevertheless, he was gracious enough to come on the air and talk to us about his book, I Am Error. It was released earlier this year, as you mentioned, through MIT Press. And it's a different kind of book about Nintendo and the NES. His is a platform study that delves more into the console itself and the technology that drove the machine, as well as the games and the cartridges.
Yes, in an interesting way, like, it's a good counterpoint to an interview we did a few years ago with Tommy Tallarico, who you may know is, like, sort of like a bigger guy.
He's certainly got name clout.
He's got name clout. I mean, he is Steven Tyler's cousin. And when we interviewed him, he told us that pretty quickly. But you might remember him from Reviews on the Run.
Electric Playground. And of course,
Video Games Live, his biggest thing. But he didn't really have fond memories of the Nintendo hardware, even though he didn't have much experience with the Nintendo hardware. Granted, his only game was Color a Dinosaur, and that's, yeah.
Not
the most stellar thing to put on your resume.
No.
But, yeah, he didn't really have much good to say about the NES. However, it is a system that's worth studying from a technical standpoint, because it is interesting.
It certainly is, not just of how it came to work, but also some of the constraints that developers had to work around, and how some of the hardware choices ultimately affected some of the design and artistic choices that they would have to make. And it's actually a very interesting conversation we had with Nathan Altice, and we learned a lot from it, and we're sure that you will as well. So without delay, here now is our conversation with Nathan Altice. Thank you so much for taking time to join us here on this episode of The Arcade.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here on this, which is our 30th anniversary celebration show for the Nintendo Entertainment System. And you are here because your book, I Am Error, is a kind of a look back history book about the Nintendo Entertainment System and Nintendo at that time. But it differs from other history books written about the company and the system, especially ones, say, like David Sheff's Game Over, where you take more of a focus onto the technology and hardware side of it. And why did you choose to take that aspect to the book?
Well, partly that's because it's part of a series, which is called the Platform Study Series. And that is part of a series that's done by MIT Press. So being, you know, kind of an academic press, that it has a particular kind of argument that's driving it. So, I mean, the book ends up being,
necessarily historical, number one, because most of these things and this technology took place, as you say, you know, almost 30 years ago now. But there is a certain way that the technology progresses historically, so some things are going to be in sequence, but it's not specifically written as a history. So I'm not mentioning, you know, like all the key players. I'm not trying to cover chronologically all the games that came out. Really what we're trying to do is take an approach that looks at how the specific assemblage of hardware affected the way that the software was produced. So a lot of times when scholars look at, you know, digital objects, as we call them, video games or software, things like that, there's a focus on kind of what appears on the screen. And that's not always really the full story of what's going on. Of course, there's always, you know, artists that have a particular style, musicians that bring their style to it, but they are always constrained by what the particular hardware affords them to do. So, you know, if you only have X amount of colors to work with, then you have to adapt your style to, for lack of a better word, the style of the architecture. So that's kind of the driving impetus behind the platform study series. And mine is, I think, the fourth book, and now there's been at least one after mine as well. So they all have that kind of, that preoccupation driving the argument of the book.
Do you at least have a better appreciation of the system now that you went through, wrote the book and had that process and did all the research to understand the hardware capabilities of it more? Or, do you find yourself maybe just not wanting to necessarily look at it because you had all that work involving it, not all of which, as you said, was fun and games?
Yeah, I think it's the former. I mean, I have, I think, a deeper appreciation of it. I mean, it's been a hobby of mine since probably about 2002 or three. I mean, understanding how the hardware works. I mean, I've been a part of, you know, there's a small community of Nintendo developers, and I don't consider myself one of those. I mean, I can make small things happen, but I've never made my own NES game. But I've always been fascinated about the way that it works. And I think that's partly because wanting to understand what my fascination with the machine was as a kid. But I'm also, you know, I have that fascination with most video game platforms just because, you know, I have an affinity towards computers. You know, I've worked as a programmer and a developer, and I think that part of it just gives me a kind of curiosity about the way that they work. But the more that I've understood about NES, the more that I'm kind of amazed that anybody got anything working on it, because it's so constrained. I mean, and part of that is looking back from, you know, the perspective of 2015. But just the memory constraints, the graphics constraints, the number of sound channels that you had to work with, the colors, the way those colors had to be arranged, the limited amount of sprites. It's remarkable that people got something like Super Mario Brothers to come out of that machine. And even looking at bad games, you can really find something like, oh, that's a really interesting trick, how they got the scrolling to work, or those tiles are really well put together. There's always something that you can find, I think, interesting about any game. And sometimes it's more important to look at the bad games. Why did they fail? What were the, you know, kind of historical or economic or sociological reasons why those games just didn't work out for whatever reason? So yeah, I mean, it's given me a really deep respect for the developers of that time, for developers today, for the artists of that time, and a different way to kind of look at the games, whether they're good or bad.
Now, you touched on it there. I'm glad you brought it up because I've been wanting to bring it up as well. You spoke of the constraints of the machine and its memory and mentioned Super Mario Brothers, which many people will consider the seminal game of the system. It is the game that people will remember back to and point to almost instantly once you mention the system. Am I to understand correctly that the size of Super Mario Brothers itself, the game, was no more than 40 kilobytes?
That's correct. Yeah, that's graphics and code all together.
So how did Nintendo go about achieving that, compressing the whole game down to what is no more than, well, JPEG files that we have now are super
right.
much larger by comparison to that? How did Nintendo go about doing that through your research, did you find?
Well, first, you know, we do have to kind of go back 30 years and think 40 kilobytes then was actually way more, you know, than it is now. So that's the first thing. So it wasn't as steep a prospect as it seems now, but it was still, I mean, you know, Miyamoto and Tezuka even talked today about they faced limitations at the time. And there's a number of tricks or programming techniques that they used. Partly that was on the graphical side. So 8 kilobytes of that 40 are all the tiles that you see on the screen. And one way that they save space is they use a lot of mirroring. So if you look at a lot of objects on the screen, they're really just two halves of a flipped sprite. So, you know, you have a mushroom, but it's really just two halves. Well, if you think about it, if that mushroom is constructed from four tiles, by mirroring it along that vertical axis, you've reduced the tile count by half. So then you have two tiles that can just be flipped in hardware because the NES can flip a sprite without adding any extra memory. Then all of a sudden you've opened up for two more tiles. And if you create a lot of objects like that, like the power-up star or the flower, lots of different things like that, then suddenly you've saved a bunch of tiles. The other way that they do it is in code. So the way that the screen is drawn in Super Mario Brothers, the way that the level data is stored is really super clever because the amount of memory that it takes just to draw all the tiles on a screen, you would only be able to fit a handful of screens for an entire game. Not even enough screens to make level 1-1, for instance. But the way that they did this is that there's basically a background layer, and this is in software, this is not in hardware, but this is the way that the kind of paradigm that they use to design it is there's a repeating pattern of backgrounds that when you're scrolling, it's something, you know, it depends on the stage, but it's X amount of tile columns wide. And that repeats over and over again. And if you jump the flagpole in the game, for instance, using a game genie or by his superior skill, you can notice that the timer just eventually times out. You don't get to an end of the level. And that is how you're kind of seeing the procedural background of the way this thing works is that background layer is just scrolled over and over again until it reaches a flag, a literal flag that you hit when you hit the flagpole that tells the level that it's done. The way that the actual the level is drawn is using that backdrop, which is kind of like a tapestry. There's a list of items that are drawn on top of that background. And in the code, when you look, you find the data in the source code for Super Mario Brothers that describes the level. It's really just a list of bytes that are telling the positions of, okay, there's going to be a question mark at row 3, column 2 on this particular page of graphics. And then beside that is going to be a brick. And it turns out that doing it that way, using this kind of object-based model, saves tons and tons of space. There are also, you know, you'll notice if you go back and play Super Mario Brothers that you can't scroll left. Once you go to the right, that's it. You know, it kind of locks the screen into place. You can only scroll one way. And part of that is a memory constraint. Because of Super Mario Brothers, the way that you can break blocks, there's really no way to store that information in memory. So if you were able to go left, you would have to store that information of which block has been hit, which enemy has been killed, so on and so forth. And when you're scrolling the screen, the world is only drawn basically about 4 columns ahead and behind of the existing screen. It's a little more than that. I forget exactly what it is. Because there's not enough memory for the NES to actually hold the entire level in memory all at once. It's basically frantically drawing extra columns to the right of the screen as you're scrolling forward. The reason it does that is because it has to compress that information in memory. And you can kind of see this in practice when if you kick a shell off the screen, if it goes far enough, even if there is a pipe slightly beyond the right of the screen, it never comes back, right? It just disappears. And they even, it's funny, Nintendo even explains this away in the instruction manual. If you go back to the Super Mario Brothers booklet, they say, sometimes if you kick a shell, the enemies to the right will jump over it. And it was their way to kind of explain, well, this thing gets erased from memory if it goes too far because the screen's just not drawn that far anymore. So there's just like dozens of these examples of ways that they were just trimming away graphics, trimming away in the code to fit all this stuff in, to actually be able to fit, you know, like 32 different worlds into the game. And I mean, if you're interested, there's a whole chapter on that. And I just wrote a Gama Sutra article called The Long Shadow of Super Mario Brothers that explains it in a little less technical sense as well, if the book is a little too heavy.
I actually bookmarked that article. I was going to be reading that a little bit later on.
Yeah. So the book is like the really intense technical description. That's probably the most technical chapter in the book. And then the article is kind of a summary of how those things work. And I just find that fascinating because the programmers that did that were so clever about how to fit all that stuff in. They solved a really complex problem. And after that, the only way to improve was to actually add more hardware inside the cartridges.
So my next question was going to be, because going from Mario 1 to, let's say, Mario 3, there was a significant jump in functionality there. Like, you could go backwards, and it did store the state of, like, which question mark boxes had been pilfered of coins or whatnot. So,
right.
I guess what you're saying is at that point, they actually had to add more memory or additional hardware into the cartridge itself.
I mean, that's exactly right. And there was some precedent for doing this in previous systems, like Atari kind of changed their ROM boards at a particular point in time. But the Nintendo is a really weird system and particularly challenging for people that are writing emulators because Super Mario Brothers was kind of designed to be the pinnacle of the stock Nintendo cartridge. It only was designed to play kind of simple arcade games. I mean, it was spec'd out to play Donkey Kong, essentially. And they didn't really plan to have these really intricate, sprawling worlds like the Mushroom Kingdom. And Super Mario Brothers, I mean, quite accurately exhausts the capabilities of the Nintendo. It fills almost every byte that's available on the standard cartridge. And initially what Nintendo was going to do to solve that was create a disk-based system. And they did that in Japan. There's the Famicom disk system. This allowed developers more memory, the ability to overwrite in memory. And it gave them more space and they were erasable and it was kind of considered to be the future. But due to various reasons, piracy being a big problem, that wasn't going to work for the United States. So what they designed to kind of work around that was they added additional chips inside the cartridges. So they created a kind of upgrade to the system that was built into the games themselves. Rather than, you know, adding an extra peripheral to the outside, which, you know, historically, if we look at add-ons to video game systems, they don't really do very well. they split the audience, you know, something like a Sega CD, and it becomes really hard to get support for those peripherals.
Yeah.
And Nintendo did something really smart by adding extra things to the cartridge. So, Super Mario Brothers 3, for instance, you know, has many times the amount of memory inside versus Super Mario Brothers, so they could improve the the memory capabilities. They could scroll in both directions and vertically at the same time. They could have way more diversity of enemies. The graphics, they could look better, but that's not necessarily, it's really because they had more tiles. There are certain limitations on the NES that you cannot circumvent without really sophisticated hardware upgrades. And for instance, like, you're never going to have more than 8 sprites on a single scan line without the extra sprites disappearing and then having to employ flickering to solve that. There's some certain hard limits that you can never circumvent, but the amount of memory that the processor can see and the amount of tiles that you can access, those things could be augmented. And Nintendo did that basically from 1986 onward, and third parties did it as well, at least in Japan for the Famicom.
So one of the more interesting, I guess, on that note, questions I have is, I mean, I'm sort of into chiptune music, and I know that often in Japan, they would have expansion sound chips as well, but oftentimes right. Those wouldn't make them, they wouldn't make their way over to North America. Do you know why exactly that was? Was it a cost thing or?
Part of it was because the unique situation with Nintendo bringing the console to the United States is because piracy was such a problem in Japan and other nations that weren't kind of officially didn't have an official release of the NES, so say in Taiwan, for instance. People were duplicating discs, people were duplicating cartridges. In the United States, when Nintendo brought the console over, they decided to have exercise complete control over the manufacture and distribution of game cartridges. So that meant that if, say, I worked for Acclaim and I wanted to make an NES game in the United States, I could give the game to Nintendo. They had full rights to censor any content or suggest changes that I then had to go back to them, fix those problems, resubmit it, then send the code for Nintendo to manufacture the cartridge and release it and distribute it in the United States. So they had, you know, developers in the United States were in this really awful bind because the Nintendo was very popular, but they had these kind of really draconian restrictions that they had to adhere to. And then Nintendo partly did that for noble reasons because the video game market crash in the United States was so severe that to get a video game console back into the market and make it viable, they had to ensure that the quality control that happened on the Atari didn't happen again on the NES. So they thought up these kind of harebrained schemes like the seal of quality, which really didn't mean anything. but really it was regulatory control over what kind of games were produced, how many were produced, when they were produced on the console. In Japan, because there was no restrictions on that and third parties had a little more leeway, they could actually develop their own cartridge hardware and produce it in their own cartridges. So Konami, for instance, decided that they wanted to add extra sound channels to their game. They could build that into their own cartridge because they actually had control over the manufacture of that cartridge. And additionally, the way that the NES was designed was there's this really weird expansion port on the bottom of the system that was initially, my guess is that the disk system was planned for here and other peripherals, but it just didn't work out. But the audio channel in the Famicom connects up differently than it does in the NES. In the NES, it's routed through that expansion port. So without that, you can't really put extra hardware in the cartridge to have the sound routed properly through the audio outputs. Whereas in the Famicom, it was kind of built in to do that. So the cartridge, if you added extra sound hardware, it would just be piped through the regular audio output. And that's a real shame because some of those audio hardware additions are really beautiful.
Well, the VR6 and 7 were crazy.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Yeah. And some of the soundtracks that were made on those, you know, in order to be ported to the NES, they really had to gimp them terribly. You know, they had to take out different voices or rearrange the tracks. And, you know, one of my favorite soundtracks that any Nintendo game is from Gimmick, which is, you know, a Famicom exclusive game. It was released in a weird territory in Europe, but its soundtrack is beautiful and it only really works with that additional hardware added.
Similar to Castlevania 3, I guess, with just for my own personal taste, I guess it's a similar thing where they had the extra channels of the VRC6. But I guess they, for that one, they completely rearranged the soundtrack and somehow still made it work.
Yeah, I mean, that's still a great soundtrack. I love that one too. But when you hear the Famicom version, you realize what you've been missing in your life all these years. Exactly. You know, it's so superior to it. It sounds so much richer. But they did a really good job porting that one over. So, I mean, but it is a loss. You know, it's not exactly as the developers intended it to sound originally.
You mentioned the idea of partnerships there between Nintendo and Ryko. And another thing I found interesting when I was reading through I Am Error was that there are two moments, two partnerships, you could argue, that struck me anyway as being moments where the course of Nintendo and perhaps North American gaming, and perhaps even modern video gaming as we know it, console gaming rather, could have gone in a completely different direction. Those being Nintendo almost had a partnership with Coleco for the ColecoVision and almost had a deal with Atari. Can you maybe expand a bit more on those two aspects?
Sure. So Nintendo, you know, in the course of their movement from being like a card company and then various other businesses and then a toy company, you know, they made lots of toys, to that move to making digital games and other arcade games, they went through a series of steps to kind of, you know, they always had their sights set on a kind of international market. And the first kind of successes that they had, they actually had a very early partnership. I believe it was with Magnavox during the kind of Odyssey era. And this isn't really well known, but they had some part, I forget exactly what it was, in like developing the light gun technology for that system. Because Nintendo had invented this light gun, basically an early version of Duck Hunt, where you would play with an actual gun and this really like, really beautifully inventive kind of mirror and light system that would project on the wall. And they had experimented with these kind of light gun games in bowling alleys in Japan as well. And so there were some early partnerships in the US market. And then of course there were the arcade games were kind of their first success with Donkey Kong Jr., Popeye. An earlier game called Radar Scope that was not a success. And then also the Game & Watch handheld systems, which if you look at them nowadays, they look like the precursor to the Nintendo DS, which were basically these very simple kind of LCD games that were very popular in Japan in the 1980s, early 80s, late 70s. And so when Donkey Kong was a success, you know, back then the arcades really ruled the video game industry. And when consoles came out, they were really trying to tap into the arcade market. So it was really important for them to get licenses for popular arcade games so you could play them at home. And Coleco licensed from Nintendo Donkey Kong, and they made a really great port. It was one of the best ports for the ColecoVision system. And Nintendo, in the course of doing business with Coleco, were really impressed with the way that the port turned out. They were really impressed with the ColecoVision as a piece of hardware. And it was just a matter of kind of historical timing where the video game crash took down almost all the console manufacturers in the United States at the time. So the Atari tanked out, and Coleco was one of those casualties. The ColecoVision was a really great system. It was technically much better than the Atari 2600, arguably maybe even the 5200. And they had really great arcade ports, but it was just the timing was bad. And so that fell through. And then the Atari deal was sort of similar circumstances. Basically, some Atari executives visited and saw the early hardware for the NES when it was still in the prototype phase. And they were looking for kind of the hardware architecture for the successor to the 5200, which had been a disappointment. So what would eventually become the 7600? And they basically had the choice between the Nintendo and what would become the 7600. And they were basically stringing Nintendo along. You can go back and see the kind of internal memos that were exchanged between the executives. And they said, oh, we kind of are leaning more towards this, but we want to see what Nintendo is working on. So that just became a kind of business decision where they decided Atari was the one that decided. So, you know, it could have been the Atari NES or Atari Entertainment System if history had changed. But the way that the legacy turned out was that Commodore really thought that Nintendo had stolen all their ideas from like the Commodore 64 and their computers. But really, if you look at the way the hardware is designed, if you can accuse Nintendo of stealing anything, their system is very similar to the ColecoVision. Although the processor is different, I mean, that's a Z80 system, if I remember correctly. The way that the graphics design is implemented, the way that the sprites are handled, it's almost identical to the ColecoVision. And Nintendo, I don't know if they stole or they just borrowed or were just inspired by those ideas, but it's really a kind of, you know, a big brother to the ColecoVision, not any other system.
All that and many other very interesting tidbits I found in your book, I Am Air. Mr. Altais, thank you for taking the time to join us here on The Arcade. Before we let you go, let the people know, let our audience know, where can they find your book, I Am Error?
You can find it on all reputable online retailers. I guess Amazon is probably the simplest. Some Barnes & Noble stock them. If they don't, you should get them to order it for you. And of course, MIT Press, you can purchase directly from them. I've had some folks that are kind of clamoring for an ebook version, and admittedly, the MIT version is not ideal. It's kind of DRM laden and not so easy to get and kind of expensive. Rest assured, that is not under my control. So when you're sending me tweets or emails with your disgusts, you can redirect those elsewhere. That's not my business decision to make. But yeah, probably Amazon is the simplest way to grab a copy. The price has been, you know, going up and down since it's come out, but it's leveled out around $30 or so. But eventually I think there might be a different ebook solution. I'm not really sure. It's nice to have a physical thing in your house, don't you think?
I certainly do. And you know what? It just looks, if nothing else, as good decoration that you're a person of great, a well-read individual. Just to have the books on your shelf. Doesn't matter if they're touched at all. You can impress people with their simple presence.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The more books that you have, the smarter that you look. It's worked for me.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Altais. We really appreciate it, really enjoyed it, and we'd love to talk to you again at some point in the future.
I would love to. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Have a good night.
Little bit of Akumaju Densetsu soundtrack there for you, which is the Japanese version of Castlevania 3, which I had mentioned, being a huge nerd myself about Nintendo music. You might have noticed they sounded maybe a little bit richer than normal Nintendo music.
You might have thought that came off a Super Nintendo soundtrack.
Yes, or something to that effect. No, that's the Japanese version of Castlevania 3. As we mentioned, as we also learned a little bit about different chips and stuff during that interview, Japanese manufacturers had a little bit more freedom with sound chips and stuff due to the architecture, and I just thought it was a fitting choice for, you know, intro and outro music to that interview there.
You know, with Nathan Altais, certainly, as he expressed, he loved that soundtrack as well.
Yes.
And, well, just the sound, what you could do with the VRC6.
Yeah. And just other, yeah, I mean, just a good technical interview there for the nerds out there.
It really was. It didn't get too into the weeds. It wasn't too inside baseball, if you so wish to refer to that. I mean, it didn't go too completely in depth to lose people, but you can still come away with a lot of really interesting things about it. The book of what I've read so far of it, I Am Error, it's a very accessible read, I do have to say. It's not a complete technical manual.
I mean, considering the man has a PhD and it was put out by MIT Press, that might be a little bit scary, but no, it's not a heady tome.
Certainly not. And if you wish to indulge and tackle it yourself, the link to it, again, is on our website, thearcadeshow.com, as are the links to get any of these books from any of the authors we had earlier on this program. And we'll mention them once more before we end off the program, because we still have some business to get to here on this episode of The Arcade. Sure, it's our 30th anniversary special, celebrating the 30th anniversary of the NES. Not our own 30th anniversary. That's a little self-indulgent, and this show's not 30 years old.
No, it would be ridiculous if it was. The first 25-ish years would be garbage.
We'd be very young and don't know how we would put a show together. Nevertheless, we, on every episode, talk about, something at the end where we leave you with something to check out and try in our Blast from the Past segment. This week we're doing something a bit different with it. It's not any sort of, big milestone this week that's being celebrated, a movie, TV show, album, or anything of that such. Instead, we're using this opportunity to talk about our own favorite, our own most memorable NES games.
Indeed.
And I have two that I've selected, two that stand out more to me than the rest. There are others, such as, say, Paperboy, that I would play religiously after school when I'd come home, or say Mega Man 4, or even, the Mario Brothers games, which of course every kid had back in the day. But the one that stands out to me for playability factor is Dr. Mario.
Yes, I mean, I know how much you enjoy that game. And in terms of puzzle games, I mean, it was, the first one that I played that wasn't, that sort of like really expanded on the Tetris idea without ripping it off, and sort of set the stage for other, I think it set the stage for other type games like Bejeweled and whatnot.
Oh, certainly did. Like
Candy Crush.
As we now live in the casual puzzle game era.
Yeah, I mean, much more than Tetris really did. I mean, Tetris was sort of its own brilliant thing right on its own.
But it was seemed more a specific genre.
Yeah, and it was just sort of like one specific idea unto itself that, like, no matter what, you're going to look at it and go, that's Tetris. But Dr. Mario, in many ways, opened up this sort of idea where it was just like match four. And you could swap out the pills with other things, and it wouldn't be Dr. Mario anymore. It could suddenly be, columns, or...
Certainly it could be columns, but it also introduced the idea of cascading and having pieces that wouldn't be eliminated as soon as you got rid of an entire line, say as there was with Tetris. You could cascade pieces, and that's really the key to getting huge points and top scores in the game, is you have to work cascade after cascade, meaning you basically are waiting on one final piece to then eliminate one row of viruses, and then another, then another, then another. And as you continuously clear them, your point score multiplies.
Yes, which wasn't present in the first Tetris.
It sure wasn't. And I love Dr. Mario because, one, it's one of the few NES games I'm actually very good at. But two, I find even to this day, I can still play it, and I still enjoy it to the same extent as when I did back in the day. And I actually probably enjoy it more now than when I did, because I was horrible back then. I was absolutely horrible. I could play it, but now I've come to appreciate it in a different light, and I still play it almost every day. And it doesn't lose anything, even though it's a game and concept that's 25 plus years old. It came out in October of 1990. It has lost nothing for me. And the other one I wanted to talk about is not a game that I played growing up on the NES, because I didn't have it back then. I've come to it later in life. It's a game on the NES, but not one I'll speak of for nostalgic memories, but it's just one I really like that happened to be on the NES. It's Tetris 2, and I really love it, and playing it for one simple reason. It is so goddamn bizarre.
It is pretty bizarre.
When you hold it up and compare it to Tetris 1, you'll wonder, how is it even called Tetris 2? The idea of the tetraminos falling and simply needing to be put into shapes and forms and pieces that fit together to form a complete line across is gone. I mean,
It's actually, I think it's more similar to Dr. Mario in that sense.
A little bit. It does remove the idea of clearing lines.
The idea of clearing lines is still there, though, isn't it?
You still can if you line up similar colors, four or more of the same color, but your tetramino, which they have almost entirely new shapes in Tetris 2, some of them are just buggers, but within that shape, it might be four blocks, but you'll have three different colors, which adds to the challenge. You also have the idea, not just of cascades, as we saw with Dr. Mario, but the idea that your piece can separate. So say it's is forming, imagine the Z piece, if you will, from Tetris. Except that one, when you land the top two pieces, you can then continue and move the bottom two pieces.
Yeah.
And move them throughout your playfield, manipulate them, rotate them. And the idea of Tetris 2 is not to clear lines. It is simply to get to the bottom of your playfield and eliminate the flashing, the blinking lights, one for each color on your playfield. One yellow, one red, one green piece. If you eliminate those blinking ones, doesn't matter if it's the very start of your round. You eliminate all those, colors, all, yeah, all the same colors from your playfield, which can lead to a huge ass cascade. I have actually had it happen where within the first minute, I have just cascaded the entire field and I've won the round.
Yeah.
It's a hell of a game, but it is so hard to wrap your head around, especially if you go into it thinking it's Tetris and it's going to be like this and I know the concept and it's familiar to me. No, 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 no. And there's really not been a game like it since. That I've played and experienced the same way. So for that reason, I'm going with Dr. Mario and Tetris 2. You all probably know where my game preferences lie now.
Yeah.
I like puzzle games, nevertheless.
Yeah.
But I could still appreciate all the, you know, major titles from back in the day as well.
Yeah. I mean, like, for me, it's such a hard choice, but it's also in many ways such an obvious choice. I mean, there's plenty of honorable mentions I could make, like the first Final Fantasy game for its significance in like sort of starting the whole JRPG thing. You know, well, it and Dragon Warrior both mm-hmm. starting the JRPG thing in North America, or, you know, Tetris as well for just being sort of like a curiosity that still kind of holds to this day. Even though it wasn't necessarily exclusive to the NES and definitely isn't anymore, or any number of the various games. But I think for me, I would have to really just say my favorite NES game is Super Mario Brothers, the original, the first.
And why is that? Why? What about that game?
Well, it was that was the video game that got me into video games. It was the first, I mean, not counting those like Tiger Electronics, like kind of crappy Game & Watch-esque games that you would, you know, play. I mean, I remember trying a couple of those first and thinking, oh, neat. But then I saw an NES, I played Super Mario Brothers, and my mind was blown. I thought, this is crazy. This is like, it's like, I didn't know you could have entertainment like this. It seems so fluid. And I mean, if you go back and play the first Super Mario Brothers game today, it still holds up. Like the animation, the physics, they don't feel dated.
That's true, actually. That's an important point.
I mean, there was just so many things about it, like how, you know, you felt like you gained velocity. Like it took a second to wind up into like your full running speed, and then you didn't stop on a dime. You had to like, you know, you slid for a second there when you're stopping. Mm-hmm. Things like that. I mean, sometimes you wouldn't jump quite high enough because you didn't hold the button long enough. Little things like that. I mean, you know, if you jumped up without running first, you couldn't, like, your velocity wouldn't be that, like, it felt right. Like, everything about it felt right. Cause like, you know, after that, like after I played Super Mario Brothers, I would play other games like, you know, Mega Man or whatever else. And like they had completely different controls and they felt crazy to me.
Especially with Mega Man 1, which seemed to lack friction sometimes. And
oh, exactly. And it just like everything was just like a one-to-one motion for the controller. And I mean, a lot of games were like that, but Super Mario Brothers still stands out in my mind as just kind of like being a very notable thing where it's just like it brought the concept of physics and velocity in, and it felt like there was like a good motion to the game. And all that aside, I mean, even still, it's just like, it was the only game I owned for quite a long time. I mean, we would rent plenty of games, but in terms of like owning games, like back then games were like, you think games are expensive now? They were really expensive back then.
That's true, actually.
So I mean, like we complain about $60 games now, but games were still $60 back then. And $60 was not worth the same thing then as it was now.
That is true.
Which is like something to keep in mind. So like we would rent games, but the game I owned for the longest time was Super Mario Brothers, and it wasn't just me who played it. I remember, you know, my parents would play it. My dad was the best at the game. Like, my dad doesn't play video games anymore, but he played the crap out of this game. When we got a Nintendo in the house, I think my dad played this game more than I did for like a while. I mean, No, I got the Nintendo for my birthday or something, or I don't remember what it was, birthday, Christmas. I was pretty young, but yeah, I was just like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. And you know, I would just play that whenever I got home from school or whatever. But I remember getting up after my bedtime because I thought I heard video game sounds and my parents were playing the game. And I was like, oh, they're like, no, go back to bed. I was like, okay, But no, I remember definitely like my dad played the game a lot. And that's one of those things too that I just kind of find interesting that it sort of, you know, brought some people together, and that's something I didn't know that, you know, video games could do yet because obviously it was new, but hindsight we have that, you know, video games are a good way to bring people together as well. And it's, yeah, I don't know. It's just, for me, it's just one of those like, things where it might not be the greatest game of all time or anything, but it's a damn good game and it still holds up. I actually did play it on the Nintendo Entertainment System somewhat recently, and yeah, it holds up.
It really does. And something you mentioned in there is the connection, the ability to create a connection between people and a bonding experience between people over just this one common thing, which for so many of us was the Nintendo Entertainment System and games, and playing it with our siblings, older, younger, playing it with friends, trying to cheat at this game, or, you know, always having to have this one game and hand it off to your one friend in the group who could just always get the game to work, you know, who had the magic touch, right? Yeah. We remember those sorts of things. But, you know, for a lot of kids now, they won't have that same touchstone to the NES because it's, well, it's just beyond them. However, I'm pleased to say that I'm trying to form those own connections, those own bonds with my nephew, my 4-year-old, going on 5-year-old nephew, who anytime he comes over for a visit, he sees my wall of video games because I've been buying, you know, crap, and ever since I've had a job for, you know, many years now.
Yes.
Buying crap I don't need.
Yep.
That's what you do with your paycheck. And one of the first things I did when I started, you know, in my mind making real money when I started having a regular full-time job, regardless of how crappy the pay was, but you're working enough hours that it's actually accumulating into something every paycheck, would be going to a used game store and buying up old Nintendo games. And in the years when I was doing that, I happened to acquire the 3 Turtle games for NES because I wanted them, because turtles, I love turtles, and it's on the NES, magic, I have to have them. And so now whenever my nephew comes over for a visit, he sees them and he always gravitates towards the Turtles ones. He can see them. They're on a shelf that just happens to be eye level to him because he's knee high to a grasshopper.
Yes, using the cigarette company's technique.
Unintentionally, I assure you. Or cereal company tactic as well. But he comes over and he can see. And I have Turtles 2, the arcade game for NES, in the box still. And he can see he can recognize the shape and color of the turtle logo right on the top of it. And anytime he comes over, he immediately goes right to that one, asks if we can play games. And so now as, this has gone on, he's not just coming over, he's not just pointing out, and he's not just sitting and watching anymore. He's now becoming an active participant in the playing of the game with me, which is a tremendous bonding experience. I mean, let's face it, he's 4 going on 5. He ain't got game skills to save his life. That ain't happening.
Those don't develop for a few years.
Well, certainly not. So it's only been in recent times that he's been able to piece together jump and attack. So, and figure out that they're different and work them, but he's getting there. And I think one time my sister happened to be over as well and took a photo of the two of us from behind, just sitting there on the carpet in front of the TV, playing Turtles on the NES together. What more do you need? That's what the NES is. It's a system about connection and bonding, really.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a good note to go out on for this, our 30th anniversary special about the release of the Nintendo Entertainment System in North America. It's been an important system in our lives, in most people's lives, and into the lives of, well, just gaming industry people as well, and the whole console way of life of gaming in North America. So we thought an important date to celebrate, and we're glad you could join us for it. But an important programming note before we leave you completely here. We are going to be taking next week off because we need to recover from, one, putting this show together.
Yes, all these interviews did take a toll.
It's actually a lot of effort, a lot more effort than what we're used to line everything up and coordinate and the logistics side of things. But we also have another big show in the offing as well, because in 2 weeks' time will be our annual Halloween music show. The show, if you've never heard it before, where we just forsake talking about video games because it doesn't really matter because it's Halloween.
Yes, Halloween is a very important holiday.
Because we're still kids.
Yes.
We're still young at heart.
Yes, and I can't really eat tons of candy anymore, but I like to think about tons of candy. And I don't really like the traditional Halloween music. It's played out. It's kind of boring.
Monster Mash. Thriller, One-Eyed Purple People Eater, and then what else is there?
Yeah.
You've kind of run the whole gambit of what you're going to hear on FM stations, in the mall, just in general existence around Halloween. And we think that there's more Halloween music out there that can be played.
Yeah.
And so each year we put in the work, the elbow grease, the legwork to suss out, to find it, and to bring it to you in our own Halloween music show. And we will have that for you in 2 weeks' time. It's looking pretty good. I kind of like how we've got things lined up this year. But then again, I say that every year. So do join us for that. So that will be in 2 weeks' time, getting posted on Friday, October 30th. But until then, we thank you so much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. You can reach out and connect with us through the power of email. Our address is info@thearcadeshow.com or just using the contact us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com, which will also be where you can find the links to learn more about the authors and also go purchase the books. Again, Jeff Ryan with his book, Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. You'll find the link to again on our website, as well as you'll find the link to Blake J. Harris's book, Console Wars, and Nathan Altize's book, I Am Error. Again, all the links for you to go purchase these books, these wonderful books, again, on our website, thearcadeshow.com. You can also reach out and connect with us over Twitter. We are at The Arcade Show, and on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Give us a like. And also you can find us on iTunes. Feel free to subscribe. Feel free to review. Feel free to 5-star. Is that too presumptive? Can I do that? Can I just say
at least 4, please?
Come on. Anything less than 4 is really just, you're insulting. Come on now.
I'd be okay with 3, but you know.
I think we're 5. why settle low? Set the bar high.
Fair enough.
So
be disappointed when people think slightly less than that.
Well, obviously they have the problem, not us. I'm just gonna put that out there. And also find us on the Garbage Hill Network, garbagehillnetwork.com. And so that about wraps us up for this week. Thank you so much for joining us once again, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks for the Halloween Music Show. So until then, everybody, good night.
Good night.